The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Enter Shaqiri, the best calves in the Premier League. Deflect Liverpool back to the top of the table as Manchester United give a predictably drab performance. What to do? Give it Carrick to the end of the season or do something, anything? City just about keep pace with the league leaders after another win, while Southampton end Arsenal's unbeaten run and their own winless one. Elsewhere, on a weekend too wet for football, a bedraggled Roy Hodgson sees Palace win without Zaha and Spurs leave it late again. Celtic lose in Fitbar Land, a hat-trick and two assists for Messi in Spain, while Ronaldo's penalty takes Juventus 11 points clear in Italy. We'll take your questions and we'll begin with the Champions League draw on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Marcus Bean, Mark Langdon and Barry Glendenning. Marcus, you were injured at the weekend, so you didn't play in Wickham's 2-2 draw at Gillingham. Be honest, if you had been fit, would you have wanted to play in that god-awful weather?
It was freezing, wasn't it? I'm one of them players. I want to be out there on a Saturday, regardless. Training, and sometimes, you know, find it hard to pull yourself out of the dressing room. But on a Saturday, put that shirt on. Yeah, I would love to be out there.
So being a team player, clearly you must have watched in the stands, despite it being so cold.
No, I didn't. Stop exposing me.
Hey, Mark Langdon. Darren says, is Mark wearing a beautifully cut winter coat with brogues and a peak cap?
No.
The slick back winter look is still there, but you've gone a bit casual, a little bit Pep.
If Pep can pull it off, I thought I'd have a go as well.
Am I
doing okay?
I think it's working. It's working for me. Anyway, this is from Chris, Barry. After last week's podcast, it's clear Barry's hip-hop career is imminent. What will Barry's rap name be? Young Baz, Lil Baz, B-Money, The Notorious B.G., B-Diddy, Baz Khalifa.
I quite like the idea of Lil Bow Baz. And I could duet with Lil Bow Wow.
Okay.
If he's still alive, he may have been shot in a drive-by, I'm not sure.
would make it more of a Weekend at Bernie's style rap duo, wouldn't it, Barry? So the Champions League draw just been made. Man City go to Schalke, Atletico, Juve, Manchester United, PSG, Spurs, Dortmund, Lyon, Barcelona, Roma, Porto, Ajax, Real Madrid, and Liverpool versus Bayern Munich. Mark Langdon, which of those ties shines to you?
Can't wait to see that Manchester United defence against Paris Saint-Germain's front three. If Mourinho is thinking about leaving, maybe this is a good time. I mean, Neymar, Mbappe and Cavani against whatever combination he manages to go with just is going to be fun.
Do you think there'll be Manchester United fans looking at this going, I wish we hadn't got out of the group?
Yes, I mean, maybe. I mean, you always want to be in the Champions League, and they did win away to Juventus, but of course that was a bit of a fluke, really, the way that that came about. I just don't see how they've got the tools to be able to cope with that kind of attack. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that one.
We'll get on to how they defended against Liverpool in a minute, Marcus. But if Manchester United won the Champions League, it would blow everybody's mind, wouldn't it? I just don't know what I mean... Just the thought of what Jose would be like. Oh. Every part of me is almost wants it to happen.
It would be just something to behold. It's not going to happen. I think they're going to struggle against PSG. That could be anything, that score.
Up to Jose, Spurs have won both their previous Champions League meetings against Borussia Dortmund with their 5 goals in these games scored by either Harry Kane or Song Heung-min. But Dortmund, and I think some Spurs fans might look at this going, oh, I'm happy with that because they've avoided Real Madrid and PSG and Bayern. But actually, Dortmund are flying at the moment.
They are top of the Bundesliga, won again at the weekend. I still think it's one of the better draws that Tottenham could have got. But this Dortmund team is better than the sorry mess that they played last time out in the Champions League. Peter Bosch came to Wembley with no tactical plan whatsoever other than to just attack with everybody, and Tottenham booted the ball over the top and just ran through and scored. Son, interesting player because he always scored against Dortmund, even in the Bundesliga. So he definitely enjoys playing against Dortmund. Of course, an opportunity for Sancho to come and really hurt a Premier League team. I think that the big player for them at the moment is Marco Reus. Seems to be over all of his injury problems. He's probably the biggest threat to Tottenham making the quarterfinals, but not far off a 50-50 tie, this one. Maybe even Tottenham slight favourites.
End of Feb,
Spurs of Chelsea, Arsenal, and the second leg against Dortmund. That's a fun a few games, isn't it? Liverpool Bayern is seems mouthwatering to me.
They all seem mouthwatering to me, to be honest. I can't see a dud in there, but they were the two things that struck me. They all look like great matchups, and Man United look hopelessly out of their depth in that company. Liverpool, I don't think have any need to be afraid of anyone, and Mark will know far more about Bayern Munich than I.
I think Bayern will be run ragged by Liverpool's sort of energy that they've got all over the pitch. It's an ageing Bayern team. At the back, they've struggled against pace, which, of course, Liverpool have got in abundance. I mean, tactically, Klopp is miles ahead of Kovac. And, of course, in an ideal world, I think Bayern would have Klopp as their manager, but he'd already left for the Premier League. On paper, it looks like a bad draw because of Bayern's history. I think it's a good matchup for Liverpool.
Schalke, will they pose any problems for City?
No. They're really struggling in the Bundesliga this season. Tedesco, young coach, did very well last year to get Schalke into the Champions League, but it was always on fine margins. You know, they were drawing games, like just nicking them by one goal. This year, it's going against them. They've got very little quality in their team. Goretzka was their main player. He left for Bayern Munich in the summer. They're struggling in the Bundesliga. City should be able to get this one done by the first leg, I would have thought.
Obviously, we'll get Paolo's take on Roma versus Porto, and we'll hear from Sid on the Spanish sides in there. Atletico Juve, that's an exciting prospect, isn't it?
It's exciting if you like low-scoring, tight, niggly matches.
Yeah, but that kind of, you know, a bit of Chiellini, a bit of shithousery.
It is going to be very, very shithousery for sure. This is going to be a grind, I think, over 180 minutes. Simeone would take 2-0s now and then sort of try his luck in extra time and penalties. An interesting game for Juventus to see whether, you know, in buying Cristiano Ronaldo, they've now got that forward that can win them the Champions League. Always the question mark was Higuain. Was he good enough? They've upgraded in that area. They've made the best start ever in an Italian championship. So they're going well. They probably would have looked to have avoided Atletico just because Atletico are a nightmare to play over two legs.
And I just wonder if Barcelona will look at what Leon did to Man City and be a bit nervous or not.
Yeah, I mean, again, it was a nice draw on paper, but Leon have shown on both games when they outplayed City that they are capable of hitting teams on the counter-attack. And, of course, if Barca have got a vulnerability, it is teams that can hit them quickly. Fekir, Memphis as well. Just defensively, you wonder if they can hold out against Messi and co. But if there's to be an amazing, you know, how on earth did that happen kind of result, it may well come in that game.
To the weekend's football then. Liverpool 3, Manchester United 1. Gary Neville, mid-game. Manchester United don't have a centre midfielder who can pass the ball. Not one. Roy Keane, the players aren't good enough. Barney Ronay writing today, this was beyond dire. Dire squared. Dire football played in a dire fashion by a dire selection.
Isn't that dire cubed?
That's a very good point. Maybe I would DM Barney straight away and see if you can change that for the late editions. Nathan says, no question. I'm just very much looking forward to Barry describing Mourinho in a way no one else can match. Go on then, Baz.
Crikey, that's tough because we're kind of running out of ways to describe him. He was his usual defensive self yesterday after the game, insisting that the players are honest when it was put to him that perhaps they might not be trying as hard as they should be under his stewardship. And I don't think you can say any of them are, because with the possible exception of the goalkeeper, every single one of them, it's difficult to pick out any one player who played well. Mourinho has been making the point that he wants January signings, that he's made a big play, the fact that he hasn't got the players he wants. But when you look at the players he wanted that he has got, yesterday Eric Bailly played, Victor Lindelof played, Lukaku played, well, he was on the pitch, Nemanja Matic played, Alexis Sanchez was injured, Paul Pogba spent 90 minutes on the bench inexplicably, despite Jose changing to a formation for the second half that would have suited him, and he brought on Marouane Fellaini rather than Pogba. And none of those players he wanted that he got, have performed. So you would imagine that if he asked for more players in January, the board will say, well, you know, all these players you've bought are playing well within themselves. We're not going to give you the funds for more. But it's difficult to see how he can continue, but it's difficult to see how United will sack him, because who would take his place?
Marcus, do you think it's dishonesty of those players? They're not performing at the level they can. Mm. Is that because Jose just can't get a tune out of them, or is it because they just don't want to play for him?
I think, just from the outside looking in, it looks like, they've down tools. I think the reaction after they lose the ball is very telling. People waving their arms and, not running to win the ball back. And that's what you expect as a professional footballer. And I think they almost look demotivated. And I think that's come from the manager.
And have you ever had that? The manager obviously inspires you to a certain level, right? And you have your professional pride. And those two things, in a perfect world, end up with you busting every sinew. But have you busted more sinews for certain managers than others?
Yeah, I think it's a subconscious thing. I don't think I consciously do it, but I think, for example, at our club, Wickham, we've got a manager who is a great man manager and inspiring. And then I think if you ask any of the boys, you know, when they step out on the pitch, they'd run through brick walls for him. And that's come down to recruitment as well. I think some of these players' mentality at Man United doesn't seem to be of the level you'd require at that for a club that's so big.
Just one thing I'd say. I wouldn't necessarily agree that they're not trying, but I think they're just doing what they're told, and what they're being told to do is pretty vague. None of them seem quite sure what they're supposed to be doing, and you know, they're not being allowed play to their strengths.
Mark, there will be some Liverpool fans screaming at us right now for not beginning this chat with the fact that Liverpool are top of the league. They had 36 attempts in this game, and that's extraordinary for any Premier League side against any other Premier League side.
Yeah, and 11 on target as well. I think in the second half, United sort of allowed them to shoot from sort of, it started at 30 yards, and then progressively Liverpool kind of wore them down and got to that position at the edge of the area. Second half, it was there for Liverpool to kind of mess up. And I think Jurgen Klopp mentioned that afterwards, that, you know, the narrative had been that United were a team in crisis and Liverpool were going along brilliantly. And that, you know, it was all there really for Liverpool, having given away such a stupid goal for the equaliser, for them to kind of then fluff their lines in the second half. But they never panicked. Even when the chances weren't coming straight after half time, they kept playing. They kept on probing down that left hand side. I mean, you can sort of wonder what Manchester United's tactic was to allow Robertson that much space, but Robertson just kept on galloping down that flank, and I never felt really that United would hold on. I never felt that Liverpool were in danger of failing to win. It felt such a comfortable game for them. Even, you know, it got quite late, but you felt like the goals were coming. There's one team that's got a tactical plan, got enthusiasm, pace, power, and all these, you know, a tactical plan. And then the other team just really are just average.
Shaqiri, what a signing he's been.
Yeah, he's been a revelation.
For no money, basically.
People questioned the transfer. Gary Neville was highly critical of him last season, Charlie Adam too, saying he did little or nothing to try to keep Stoke up. And I think they have a point, and I would have questioned his attitude. But he has certainly delivered for Liverpool, and who, you know, he's clearly a very good player, and they swoop, picked him up on the cheap, and he's been a revelation. He seems content enough to start on the bench, but I reckon he's not too far away from a regular place in the starting lineup, possibly at the expense of Roberto Firmino. But, you know, those three front guys, they're not going to stay fit all season. Someone's going to get injured, and what a replacement to have.
I mean, one player we haven't mentioned yet, Fabinho, his best game by, you know, an absolute distance. took him a while to get going in the Liverpool team, and he played horrendously, I thought, in the first half, particularly at Arsenal. But yesterday he was played further up the pitch, and he was actually the one picking the passes all the time. Of course, it was a great one for the opener for Mane, but it was more than that, actually. He was constantly doing that, and what a player that will be now, I think, for the second half of the season, if he can maintain those levels. Naby Keita hasn't quite reached the standards I expected of him. So if he comes good, then, maybe we have got a real proper title race on. I would still favour Man City, though.
Kieran says, any news on the paramedic's condition after that Fellaini shot?
That was glorious.
We're still not sure if it's a paramedic or a steward.
It was someone in a high-vis jacket.
Someone
anyway.
In a high-vis. To be fair, Fellaini, that's harder to do.
Have been a French protester.
It could have been a very lost one. Either way, harder to do that than hit the target. So well done, Marouane. The good news for Manchester United is that Chris Smalling has signed until 2022. Why are you laughing, Mark?
It was just the fact that Mourinho made a dig, didn't he? All the players that are constantly injured in the United team, and Smalling pulled out very late. It was only a couple of minutes before kickoff, and I'm sure that's not what Manchester United fans sort of need, and the boost of Smalling signing an extended deal.
John says, how unbearable would it be for non-Liverpool fans if Liverpool won the league? Barry?
I think it would be very unbearable indeed. But, these things are sent to try us and we just have to accept it with good grace.
I remember a tweet around about the time England were playing in the World Cup semi-finals that said, the nation hasn't been this united since we wanted Real Madrid to win the Champions League final.
I think, to be fair, any Liverpool fans I've spoken to have quite openly admitted they would be insufferable should Liverpool win the league. I still don't think they will, but week by week they're showing that, it does look like they might turn it into a title race. I'm still not convinced, but we shall see what happens.
Southampton 3, Arsenal 2. Southampton thoroughly deserved this win. I actually had a tweet written saying, this is going to be so unfair when Arsenal score a winner. And as I wrote it, Shane Long crossed for Charlie Austin. It looked like a mistake from Leno. Hudson-Odoi, it was a great cross as well.
It was a fantastic cross. Curler, they sort of bamboozled the keeper, really.
And I think if he'd stayed in his goal, then yes, he'd had a better chance of saving the header, but I still don't know if he would have done. Ryan Bertrand on his Instagram, he might have deleted this post because when I went onto it, I couldn't see it. He sent this message. Clear tactical instruction, allowing us to get close to teams and press high, aggressive as a unit, and we got our rewards. Mark, it's almost as if he's saying this manager has come with some new ideas.
Yeah, in my notes, I've got aggressive and enthusiastic, really. I thought they were the two things that stood out for me and what Southampton did to Arsenal. Arsene Hüttl is a man with a plan, and I'm not sure that Hughes had one, particularly towards the end. And, the fans were down, the players looked down, and that obviously does come from the leader. It starts at the top. This was a really good performance. I think it was an ideal time to play Arsenal, we should say that, with all of the injuries they had at the back, and all three goals were balls into the box and headers into the goal, which maybe if Mustafi and Socrates are there, it doesn't happen. But I think Southampton just deserved it. They made their own luck. And you look at that team, and actually they shouldn't be where they are in the league table. And if they play like that, they'll be nowhere near relegation trouble come the end.
You mentioned sort of makeshift defence. How much harder, Marcus, is it to play out of position? Because the game changes, doesn't it, if you're in a different place?
Yeah, it changes massively. I think you see different pictures that you're not used to seeing. And I think that's the major difference.
I thought Matt Target's cross for that first header was absolutely superb, wasn't it? And yeah. And I think everybody likes Danny Ings. Does anyone dislike Danny Ings in this room? No, we like him and... Yeah. And really pleased. I saw some people criticising Emery for playing Aubameyang down the middle and saying you should play Lacazette down the middle and bring Aubameyang off the bench. I don't know if you agree with that, Marcus. Or
yeah, I think the way Arsenal play, I think Lacazette with his back to goals a far better player than Aubameyang, and he brings people into the game a little bit better. I prefer Aubameyang out wide. Obviously, I guess he wants to be down the middle, so it's tough one for the manager.
Sorry, Barry. No, I was going to say, I think they could both play down the middle, and you just maybe play no Iwobi, and then you can play 3-4-1-2 with sort of Mkhitaryan in behind the two forwards, which I think maybe would work better. But just on Emery, I mean, if Arsene Wenger had sort of gone this far into the season and not been ahead at half time, the Arsenal fans will be saying he's got no tactical plan at the start, he can't inspire his team, and yet the narrative is different. You know, it's all about what good substitutions he makes at half time. I think that,
I mean, the narrative is different because he hasn't been there, not won anything for a decade, right?
Well, I suppose, but I just think that's what happens when you get kind of a new, a bit like with Hasenhüttl, so, you know, you kind of forgive anything that goes kind of wrong early on. But I just feel that, you know, Arsenal do need, at some stage, need to start matches quicker because it's difficult to keep on, you know, recovering from these losing positions.
Two messages for you, Barry. Asked slightly differently. Michael says, does Barry still think Arsenal will finish second, or did he seek medical help after making that comment? Rephrased by Lewis, does Barry still think Arsenal are going to finish above Liverpool? The absolute whopper.
Well, those two listeners have the benefit of hindsight. I didn't when I said that. The league is a marathon, not a sprint. We shall see. As I've said before, if only there was some competition run over the course of 9 months where each team plays each other home and away, we could find out how these things will unfold.
I think whopper is one of my favourite insults, though.
Oh, it's crap, yeah.
Derek says, how do you solve a problem like Ozil? He got a lot of stick again for coming on and not doing a whole lot.
I think every manager's tried to solve that Ozil problem. I'm a massive fan of his as a footballer. I think he's very majestic. I think you've got to probably play two holding midfielders, and you've got to accept that he's not going to do the pressing side of the game. But then that goes against the manager's whole philosophy. So I think Ozil's time is numbered under this manager, which is unfortunate because I think he's a great player to watch in the Premier League.
Yeah, he's a fascinating, you know, and a terrific player. But I don't think there's a place for him in Emery's system. And yesterday, I think it's harsh to single him out for criticism on yesterday's performance because he was kind of marooned high up the field and didn't get much of the ball. I just wanted to ask Marcus, if a manager comes in, we saw Southampton's players yesterday, you know, this relentless, organised pressing that they're not used to. How difficult is it to sort of start doing that 16 games into a season when you're not used to it? Because it must be bloody tiring.
I think, yeah, physically it's going to be very demanding because I'm guessing they're not used to playing at that tempo beforehand or training at that tempo. I'm guessing he would have had to increase the intensity of training to then get those sort of performances on the pitch. So I think the next few weeks or months are going to be really telling for Southampton to see if they can really adapt to it. I think it's fine. You're running off adrenaline for the first three or four games, but eventually that can catch up with you.
I always think that sounds strange, though, when, you know, you know, there is the fittest team in the league and the least fit team in the league, or the team that runs the most and the team that runs the least. And obviously there has to be a team that runs the least. But surely they're all fit. I mean, is this fine, fine margins, or would there be a massive difference?
I think they're all fit. But then when you're asking people to do more high intensity sprints, it's a different type of running. You know, I could plod along forever in the middle of the park just running at one pace. But when I'm asked to do 10, 15 sprints in game, more than I'm probably normally doing, that can take its toll. So I do think conditioning is a massive thing. And unfortunately, this manager's come in at a time where he can't really get that conditioning into the legs. So that's why I think later down the season could tell.
He did, though, cancel their day off last weekend, had them in for extra training.
Yeah, that he also, Romeo said it was that one grueling session of 2 hours, which, I mean, for some people that kind of maybe do a normal job, like a two-hour day would seem like an absolute dream, but it obviously is probably double, and it's the intensity of what they're training.
Just hearing some of the stories coming out of Leeds and Bielsa and their pre-season, they were basically locked away, and every day they were training 9 till God knows when. I think he's had that pre-season to get that into him, and obviously you can see the results are telling. I think it's key that you increase intensity of training if you're going to try and play that way.
I mean, once one team increases it, everyone's got to follow suit, right? Or you're left behind. Fulham 0, Southampton 2. Robert Snodgrass now completely clear of his service station vortex. Another brilliant goal. But problems for Fulham, Bas. You know, Claudio Ranieri started with that 3-2 win over Southampton. Since then, defeats away at Chelsea and Manchester United. You could expect those. A draw at home to Leicester. And now a 2-0 defeat to West Ham.
They just can't defend. And when you are conceding about three goals a game, I think, as they are on average, you need to score four to win a game. And that's not going to happen. And they don't seem to be playing as a team. You know, I think if you look at the two sides yesterday, West Ham are organised, play as a team, have a plan. Fulham, not so much. It's just a collection of individuals, I suppose you could say. And I look, when Big Sam comes into a club, or Tony Pulis, say when Big Sam came to Sunderland and had to sort out a very leaky defence, it took him five or six games. I wouldn't panic just yet, but I wouldn't. My hand would be hovering over the panic button if I was a Fulham fan.
What, to sack Ranieri?
No, just...
You to know. Panic, you have a button that just says panic. nothing happens when you press it, you just press it.
Ranieri is a very, very experienced manager with a long history of sorting out the defences of teams who are in trouble. This may be a job beyond him, but, you know, it takes time. And, we'll see how they get on. But their next games are Newcastle away, Wolves, Huddersfield, at home, and Arsenal away. So they need to pick up, you'd have to say, they probably need 6 points out of that.
Possibly, yeah. 42 goals conceded in 17 games, so just under 2.5 a game.
Right, okay.
Fourth win in a row for West Ham. Finnegan says, can West Ham go 100% in December, Mark? I mean, it's interesting, because at the start of the season, we were like, West Ham might have 0 points in November.
it's a favourable fixture list of Watford at home, Southampton away, Burnley away, Brighton at home. So, I mean, these kind of middling Premier League teams don't tend to win sort of 6, 7, 8 matches in a row. So somewhere I'm sure they'll drop points. But it was an impressive performance in as much as, they didn't play that great, but they've still comfortably won the game. And earlier on in the season, maybe West Ham, I remember very early on, they played at Arsenal and did okay in that game and sort of lost it 3-1. And, you know, there was this feeling about Pellegrini that he needed to get a couple of wins, but now everybody's buying into it. And you look at the players that weren't there: Arnautovic, Lanzini, Yarmolenko. I mean, a lot of teams would struggle without that type of talent in the final third. Felipe Anderson is coming along nicely. You mentioned Snodgrass earlier on. I mean, I still think, though, the second goal from Fulham's point of view was just disgusting, really. I mean, there's so many mistakes there. I don't know. Joe Bryan, the left-back, I don't know where he was. I've watched it about 20 times. The centre-backs have all come across one, and Ream got pointed out as something. You know, he got attracted to the ball. But he's got to be expecting his left back to be behind him, and Schürrle's just watched as the goal's gone in from Antonio, and that's a big concern really for Fulham. The lack of spirit, the lack of identity which they did have in the Championship last season is completely gone.
It's so interesting, Marcus, isn't it? When just tracking a man takes so much more effort than making a run when you're attacking.
Yeah, it boggles me, and I pride myself on that as a player, is sort of not letting my man get the better of me. I think just watching Fulham, it's just a lack of intensity in their pressing and closing, and it starts from the front. It's easy to sometimes blame defenders, but any defender will tell you their job's very easy when you've got a front players that are pressing the ball. You look at Liverpool, they're just cleaning up the back four, just cleaning up scraps. It's easy for them because there's so much pressure on the ball. The ball's forward are poor. And at the moment, Fulham, it's far too easy to get into their back four.
All right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start at the Etihad. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly on the 22nd of January, Barry. What are we going to do?
We're going to go to Dublin and do a live version of Football Weekly at Liberty Hall.
Who's going to come with us?
Lars Sivertsen and Barney Roney.
Oh, that's exciting. Producer Jonathan says the promoter is sending him minute-by-minute updates on the tickets sold.
I believe they're selling quite briskly.
85% wow. Now. I mean, this isn't live, so I suppose people listening are unlikely, you know, it's not going to affect the minute-by-minute during the pod. But if they go up higher than 85% while we're on air...
That's an A.
Yeah. That's a what?
An A in an exam.
It's 85 plus, isn't it?
Is it? Oh, I reckon it's... exams are so easy. They're so easy these days, exams, aren't they? It's probably 40% for an A these days. Man City 3, Everton 1. They're quite good, Marcus, aren't they? I sort of run out of... It's a bit like Jose. It's running out of things to say about Manchester City because you just knew they were going to win and it wasn't that exciting because you knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, I know. It's, the Premier League's in danger of becoming a bit boring in a minute, to be honest, with them being so good. They were very good, but they conceded one too many chances that game. I think Pep wouldn't be, and he's very critical of his team, he wouldn't be too pleased with some of the stuff he saw. But yeah, it was comfortable in the end.
That's the key, isn't it? If you're Everton, if you're a team going there, when you have big chances, you've got to take them. Richarlison had one, Walcott had one, and they didn't take them.
You're making it sound like they missed on purpose.
They were being dishonest at that exact moment. And also, if you play one up front, the ball's got to stick, right?
It's got
to stick, and it didn't stick with Calvert-Lewin. It's a bit like Lukaku at Manchester United. It just didn't stick, and that means if you're playing behind him, then it's just coming back all the time.
Yeah, in fairness, he has to stick, but he's outnumbered 2-1 there. And I always say good defenders, you know, one mark in front, one mark behind. It's very difficult for a striker. He was very isolated. But yeah, Man City were phenomenal again.
And the only weak link of Man City, inverted commas, was that Jesus wasn't really scoring, Mark, and two lovely finishes from him.
I think he needed the goals for sure. And Sane put on some lovely sort of passes for him. I just looked at the bench, De Bruyne, Aguero, Sterling, Stones, and they've beaten, you know, seventh, eighth best team in the Premier League pretty comfortably. It doesn't bode well. Just from Everton's point of view, I thought they missed Idrissa Gueye in midfield because that's when I saw it on paper, Sigurdsson and Gomez, central midfield away to Manchester City, that did sort of spell trouble. And I know one of your pet hates, Max, playing out from the back. Yerry Mina got done for the first goal. I understand why teams do it, and we saw Liverpool actually score a goal against United from that point of view, and Tottenham scored one against Barcelona playing out from the back, but City had a full press on, and Pickford has given the ball to Mina virtually on the line with no option of a pass, and he couldn't do anything really other. He could have hoofed it a bit further maybe, but he had no option on, and I blame Pickford as much as anybody for that goal really, because...
Yeah, although Mina, once you've done that, then you've got to get back in line, right?
Yeah, but that's, again, that's easier said than done. I mean, he could have sprinted up maybe, but I mean, I think Pickford there has chose the wrong option. Dinier and Coleman on the flanks were available. He's got a good kick on in Pickford. He could have, you know, hit it further forward, and it was just sort of sporting suicide really to do that.
Watford 3, Cardiff 2. I mean, it was just a goal of the season competition, Mark, wasn't it?
I don't think many people had this one down as a five goal classic with four really good goals in it as well. I mean, I liked all of the Watford ones, particularly with Delafeu, that sort of individual kind of brilliance that he does sort of every four or five matches, you know, just that one moment. Hollibas, didn't expect that from him. Queener, the third goal, I mean, he's somebody that's got a real spectacular kind of YouTube highlights reel from stuff he's done with the Portuguese youth teams. There's a bit of a buzz around him, and I don't quite know why he wasn't given a chance at West Ham, but he's certainly got a lot of talent. And I thought that, you know, Watford fully deserved the win, and actually the 3-2 massively flattered Cardiff. Efridge in goal has kept the score down, really.
Marcus, do you have a fantastic YouTube highlights reel?
No.
This is from Captain Alex. Watford have been in a similar position to Bournemouth all season, have not got the praise that Bournemouth have. Why is this, Marcus? Why have you not been screaming about Watford like you are about Bournemouth, if you have been screaming about Bournemouth?
I think it's probably because there's an English manager in charge, in Eddie Howe, and we're desperate for a quality English manager to come through. As you said, I think Watford have been excellent this season. Obviously, they had a little bit of a pad patch, but looked like they're back to on good form again.
But that's just not true. They have got praise this season, plenty of praise. They've got praise in this pod. I've read praise in other papers. Their manager is highly regarded. Plenty of their players are highly regarded. So just because he hasn't seen or heard this praise doesn't mean it has not been delivered.
If you were on the Eddie Howe bus, which we're all on, and the Javi Gracia bus was going the other way? Would you get off the Eddie Howe bus and get on the Javi Gracia bus?
Well, it's more of this knee-jerk stuff. You know, Bournemouth have lost several matches in a row. That doesn't mean Eddie Howe is not a good manager or that their players aren't good. You know, Wolves had a little wobble. They lost two or three games, but they only played badly in one of them, as far as I can remember. You know, people react very, as I say, knee-jerkily to things that happen. You know, Eddie Howe is still a good manager, even though Bournemouth are in a bit of a slump at the moment.
Liam says, now Bournemouth have lost 6 out of 7. Can we please stop talking about Howe for top jobs from a Bournemouth fan? Please.
Oh, well, so he wants him to stay.
Well, arguably.
Yeah.
Wolves 2, Bournemouth 0. Third win on the bounce for Wolves after losing 5 in 6. As we said, Bournemouth 6 in 7. So what do we deduce from this? That they're both capable of winning some matches and losing some matches?
Yeah, I think that is the life, really, of a mid-table Premier League team. What I would say about Bournemouth is that one win in this really bad spell, they didn't play well against Huddersfield either, and slightly fortunate to get the win. They had a lot of possession at Molineux, but Callum Wilson wasn't fit to start, and he offers them so much more than just a goal threat. And Marcus was speaking earlier about sort of starting off the press, and I think Wilson does that as good as sort of most in the Premier League. So they really are missing, and I think most teams would, a striker of that calibre. He just got into the England squad. And when you concede early to a team like Wolves, I mean, on the counter-attack, they're one of the best in the Premier League, I think, on the break, and it became very difficult to find a way through.
I love their second goal because I was trying to think of the right adjective. It was a really big 1-2, you know, two like quite long passes, which doesn't often happen in a 1-2. Spurs 1, Burnley 0. Only the second clean sheet Spurs have kept at home this season in 7 games. But, Marcus, they're scoring this run of late goals. It's quite impressive from them, you know, in a sort of non-Spursy way of just keeping at it.
Yeah, and they're going about their business quite quietly, kind of going under the radar, but they're looking very strong. I think they're only going to gain confidence from that win against Barcelona. I think that definitely is going to... The draw against Barcelona. I think that's going to definitely give the boys some confidence. So I think they're in a good place, Spurs.
We all wish Eric Dier well. Had appendicitis, which sounds like one of the most painful things after snapping an Achilles tendon.
Well, our supply producer, Sammy, had appendicitis and he was still able to produce a pod 2 days later. So I think Eric Dier should have manned up and got out in that field.
I actually think he didn't turn up for that pod.
Well, he produced it from home. Eric Dier could have played from home.
Some people say Eric Dier could do that quite regularly. I'm not one of them. I quite like Eric Dier. I'm just sort of, what do we think about Tottenham? You know, Pochettino's saying they've still got to believe. None of us believe that they're quite that good. But they've got, you know, they've got so many home games, haven't they? Because they've been playing a lot away from home. Their away record is great. If they can get into that stadium and it's good in there.
But I mean, are we talking about to win the Premier League? Is that what, I mean, because they're going to need a point. Man City or Liverpool will probably get somewhere at least in the high 90s, maybe even, you know, close to, you know, 100 points a game. Like Tottenham can't get, I don't think, to that kind of level. And that's not a anything against the squad or Pochettino necessarily. It's just where they are really in the pecking order, and they've still got to go to Anfield and the Etihad. So, I mean, Liverpool haven't lost at all this season. I think it's highly unlikely that Tottenham, they'll need to win both those games.
And it is their last chance to win anything under Pochettino, because he'll be gone in the summer to either Manchester United or Real Madrid. And I'd say Tottenham fans are very nervous about that.
Should say Tottenham could have had about 8, and Joe Hart played very well in the Burnley goal.
I wanted that, made a note of that actually, because I've been very, very critical of Joe Hart in the past, but I think he's been playing very well this season.
Do you not think he should have saved? I mean, it was.
No. He's close, no? There, Ericsson, isn't he? And you think he could have put it in the other corner?
Exactly. Yeah, he's kind of give the keeper the eyes and reversed it. And I think it's very difficult. That's some skill, to be fair. I think it's a great finish.
Yeah. Arctic Dino says, "Have you seen how the pints are poured in the new Spurs stadium? They let 6,000 season ticket holders in, and the glass is put on a tap, which is right beneath the bottom of the glass, and fills up the pint from the bottom really quickly. And then somehow they reseal the bottom of the glass."
I've seen that before somewhere. It sounds like an absolute aberration, but...
it looked pretty good on the video.
It blew my mind. It's not a big mind, I suppose. Brighton 1, Chelsea 2. Eden Hazard, brilliant again, Mark.
Yeah, I think it was quite interesting and telling that Sarri again chose him as the centre-forward. We understood why he did it for the Man City game, but clearly he now sees that as the best way forward for Chelsea. Maybe it's a signal to the board that he'd like a striker in January, but he turned Dries Mertens into an absolute goal machine in Italy doing that. And I mean, if Hazard can get his head around, he doesn't tend to enjoy playing that role, but I think if he does get his head around it, I think he would score a lot of goals for Chelsea in that position. It was pretty comfortable win for Sarri's side, and you know that sort of Brighton goal that made it a little bit nervous, I think, give an unfair reflection on Chelsea, how comfortable they were.
You mentioned Eriksen giving the keeper the eyes. Hazard did that brilliantly with that finish.
Yeah, when he went through on goal, I had no doubt in my head that he was going to score. And it, yeah, as you said, it was an excellent finish.
Should Alonso have been sent off, Barry?
He should have been, not for the foul that he got the yellow card for, but because he should have been on a yellow anyway, and that should have been his second yellow card. But then again, he may not have done it if he was already on a yellow. But I don't think Solly March... Yeah, I don't think it was a clear goal-scoring opportunity.
Because he might not have got the ball.
Yeah. Then again, I could be doing him a grave injustice. Anyway, he wasn't sent off. He was expecting to be sent off, and I think he was very surprised when he wasn't sent off.
Off the pitch, since we did the pod on Thursday, another disappointing night for Chelsea fans. There was anti-Semitic chanting during their 2-2 draw with Vidi. There's a photo of some of the fans taking a flag to Budapest with the SS death head from the Nazi regime in Germany. The club came out very strongly with a statement saying anti-Semitism and any other kind of race-related or religious hatred is abhorrent to this club and the overwhelming majority of our fans. It has no place at Chelsea or in any of our communities. We've stated this loud and clear on many occasions from the owner, the board, the coaches and players. Any individuals that can't summon the brain power to comprehend this simple message and are found to have shamed the club by using anti-Semitism or racist words or actions will face the strongest possible action from the club. Are UEFA also looking into it? That is the strongest worded statement I've heard from a club. What was interesting was I remembered I was on the radio on the day after and they didn't tweet that out to their 12 million followers, which I thought was interesting that they make this very strong statement but didn't necessarily send it to everybody that would listen. I don't know if I'm just splitting hairs or not.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Why wouldn't they tweet it out? But they can now say they've been seen to do something, but you know what would happen if they did tweet it out and the responses that would appear underneath it. But, you know, what the hell? Twitter is a cesspit. Yeah, I think they should have tweeted it out, but I would be curious to hear an explanation as to why they didn't.
Mm. There is such a lunacy to this, Marcus, in the same way that, you know, those people giving Raheem Sterling all that stick would have cheered Kante's goal to the same point that the owner of Chelsea is Jewish, you know, has pumped millions, billions of pounds into this club. They wouldn't be at this game, whether they want to be in, you know, the Europa League or the Champions League. They wouldn't be there if it wasn't for a Jewish guy pumping in millions. Maybe you just can't assign logic to some people, right?
I just don't think you can assign a logic to these people. I think they lack any sort of common decency or I don't know what to say. It's incredible. But as you said, I think that statement was very strongly worded, and I think that's probably come from the top, the man himself, Abramovich. Because for me, if I'm pumping all that money, I expect them to be grateful, and it seems that these people aren't.
And Ennio Luca wrote in the paper the other day that this week might be a sort of seminal moment in how we deal with racist attitudes in football. Do you think it is?
I'm not sure. I'm not convinced it is. I think these things run far deeper than football. They start at home. They start when a kid's born and what family they're born into and what their views are. It then goes into the, you know, you go to school and then you hear it from other, you know, it's just so deeply ingrained. I think great that we're highlighting it, but I think as a society, we need to really look at ourselves and see, are we doing enough?
And I know you've praised Raheem Sterling a lot for how he, for finally making that statement.
Yeah, I think Raheem, as a young man, he could have just kept quiet And I've got to take my hat off to him. I think what he'd done there was very brave. You haven't seen many other high-profile players do the same thing. And I think that's what it really needs. It needs other black and ethnic minority high-profile players to come out and speak out against it. You know, it shouldn't be rest on a 24-year-old man's shoulders to be the pallbearer for kick racism out of football.
I just wonder if you, in the lower leagues, if you experience the same kind of thing?
I've personally only had one incident. It was at Blackpool. As a player, I was sat in the stands watching Preston away, who's a massive derby game for the club, and our own fans started racially abusing the Preston fans, and I sat right next to them. And that hurt a lot, as you can imagine. I was sat with Adrian Forbes, another player, and we reported it to the stewards, and the culprits were immediately ejected, which was good. But you know, if I'm sat in the stands and I've heard it before, I'm guessing there must be other cases of footballers that have experienced it.
All right, well, let's move back onto the pitch. Crystal Palace, Leicester. Barry, you were there. Did you have a nice time?
No, I didn't.
Why
and
not?
I know people are going to accuse me of being an ingrate and, you know, having a job they'd love to do or getting paid to go to football. But it just, I don't think anyone wanted to be there, to be honest. Players, Kayla, the Crystal Palace Eagle, was utterly unenthused, wouldn't do her party piece before the game. The Crystal Palace cheerleading team left it very, very late to come out and do their pre-match manoeuvres. And, you know, they were shivering in their thermal body stockings, and the quality of play was so bad, with two notable moments of exception, that you would think, yeah, the players weren't that keen on it either. Because, but Palace finally got this giant orangutan off their back by winning a game without Wilf, and I think they played 14 Premier League games in which he hadn't started, 14 consecutive games, and lost them all. And finally they won a game through a moment of pure quality from Luka Milivojevic, who scored a lovely goal from distance. And their goalkeeper, whose name I've forgotten again.
Victor Gaita.
Yeah, it was his very first Premier League start. Wayne Hennessy was out with a back spasm. And he was almost embarrassed, actually, by Jamie Vardy. He made a bit of a hash of receiving a back pass. Vardy shouldered him off the ball and poked it into an empty net. And was correctly ruled out because the shoulder had been to Gaita's back. But so he got away with that one. But he made an absolutely stunning save in the second half to keep Vardy out. Touched a ball. And Jamie Vardy, he did nothing wrong. Like, it was perfectly executed, shot a goal, looked like a goal all the way, and Gaita got down low to his right, tipped it onto the post, and luckily for him, the ball rebounded into his arms.
Roy Hodgson looked so wet and just bedraggled. And, you know, he's 71, 72 now. Surely we should have... I mean, I know Steve McLaren ruined the umbrella for managers, right? But surely, once they get over 70, they should be allowed a brolly. I mean, they should be allowed to be inside.
I agree, actually, that it was during the Tottenham game, wasn't it, that there was reference to the fact that Pochettino was getting wet, but he couldn't have an umbrella because Steve McLaren has ruined that for everybody. But I was just thinking, look, surely it's the most practical thing for a manager to kind of have on. And why do they need to be seen to be out there, you know, just getting wet? I tend to think that an umbrella actually would be fine in those circumstances.
Formula One drivers get them. They, before the race even starts, even if it's not raining, they've a lovely girl standing beside them holding an umbrella over them, and they've already wearing a big helmet and leathers. So, I mean,
hang on. I mean, if Roy had a big helmet and leathers on, then I'm right up for this. It would have to be a really good, a sturdy umbrella, though, because if they bought one of those, you know, when it's raining, you get one for a fiver from just a man who's just appeared to sell umbrellas on the corner. Because if it goes inside out and you're losing and you're having a battle with the umbrella, that would be a problem.
Well, a jacket with a hood up. What's your thoughts on that?
No, that's fine. That's totally fine.
But the thing about Hodgson was he clearly showered and changed and had a blow dry after the game because he was very late into his post-match press conference. I think he didn't come in until about 6:15, and I can't speak for anyone else, but I had to file a report, a rewritten report with quotes from Hodgson by 6:30. So I was, you know, starting to panic. But when he came in, he was bone dry.
91% of tickets sold.
Whoa.
Isn't that great? Huddersfield 0, Newcastle 1. John says, is Salomon Rondon now officially better than Morata and Lukaku? Marcus?
No. I think to be honest, Newcastle's hopes of staying up are resting on his shoulders. But yeah, he's not in that bracket.
Now, Rafa won Manager of the Month for November. 3 wins on the bounce. And, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because Rafa was getting some stick. He was starting to get... The stick he was getting, Mark, was the... Should we be starting to give Rafa stick?
Yeah,
you see what I mean?
It was pre-stick, yeah. And this was the advantage of playing out from the back. Newcastle's goal came from them being sort of brave in possession. They didn't have much of the ball, 26%, which is a shocking number, really, away to Huddersfield. But I spoke actually to a West Brom fan about Rondon the other day, and he said no, he'd much rather have Dwight Gayle than Rondon. So I think that maybe he definitely can't put him into that top quality. But for Huddersfield, if you were doing a five things we learned piece, I mean, you'd struggle, wouldn't you? Because it's the same thing every week, that they've got good possession, but they've got nothing of note in that final third. A Moyes injury, which keeps him out now until February, I think is going to be a really big blow, and difficult for them to see how they create as much without Moy, and that becomes a problem because even with him, that they struggle.
I now have this image of après stick, which is a load of recently fired managers sitting around on beanbags, you know, listening to Paul Oakenfold chill out compilations.
Lord Keir says, how does Max plan to celebrate no unnecessary away kit weekend? I was truly happy that all the kits worn were sensible and appropriate. Leicester, absolutely fine to wear an away kit. Newcastle, absolutely fine.
I don't like that Newcastle away
kit. It's a little, though. From the distance, it looks nice. As you get closer, it's a little bit Hackett rugby top for me. But it seemed the right thing to do, to at least put it on.
Marcus, have you ever had to wear a kit where you've seen it and gone, oh, God, really? You know, something just hideous.
No, to be fair, most of my kits I've actually quite liked. Right. Yeah.
But hasn't your goalkeeper got a horrendous one?
Yeah, the keepers have had horrendous ones the last couple of seasons.
What do they look like?
Like every colour under the sun in Czech. I think that the idea with Barry Richardson, our goalkeeper coach, he's now at Hull, he said that he chose a really outlandish kit to try and put the strikers off when they went up through and goal. That was his theory, and they are disgusting.
Hey, Football League news. In the Championship, Leeds are back on top after Patrick Bamford, grade 7 violin, scored the only goal at Bolton, his first appearance since August. Norwich needed a Max Aarons equaliser late on to get a 2-2 draw at Bristol City. They dropped to second. West Brom up to third after a win at Bramall Lane. Sheffield United are now fourth. At the bottom, Ipswich's first win in about 100 years. Paul Lambert's first after taking 2 points from a possible 18 so far. They beat Wigan 1-0. In League One, Portsmouth are 4 points clear at the top. 2 games without a win after being held at Barnsley. Second place Luton and third place Sunderland both won. Sunderland winning 2-1 against Bristol Rovers, who just sacked their manager, Darrell Clark. Referee Trevor Kettle gave a straight red to Charlton's Naby Sarr for a late challenge after 48 seconds in their game against bottom side AFC Wimbledon.
Would it be cynical to suggest Naby Sarr may have wanted Christmas off?
I don't know. Apparently it was a dodgy decision from Kettle.
Okay.
Wimbledon had a man sent off after half an hour. Charlton won 2-0. Paul says, a question for Marcus. Will Wickham get promoted again? And is Gareth Ainsworth's hair as wonderful up close as it looks from the stands?
Will promotion, I think, just our aim to get 55 points and make sure we stay in the league. I think we're well on course for that, and you know, anything on top of that is a bonus. So yeah, we're remaining positive, and the gaffer's hair is got great barnet, to be fair.
Do you ever stroke it?
Definitely not.
What would happen if you did, if you just went out and just said, just sort of gave it a little
All right, no, I'm going to film myself doing it tomorrow and I'll send it. I'll put it in.
Okay. Excellent news. Russell says, has Marcus ever scored a better goal than the handball from a yard at Gillingham?
To be fair, that was one. I was funny. I went into the dressing room and the gaffer said to me, "Did you mean to do that?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well done, well done." It was a quite funny one. But I've scored a couple better goals than that.
So, are you saying you're worse than Maradona? Are you saying you meant to do it and you went off celebrating wildly?
I didn't celebrate wildly, but I did mean to punch it in. I looked across, thinking that why is a linesman fucking gone up?
Surely at some point we'd be saying, one out, this is an outrage. If it's Maradona, I haven't forgiven Maradona. So, you know, how can I forgive Marcus?
Well, Thierry Henry is who I'm supposed to have beef with over handballs, but I never really got upset about that one. It was Shea Given's fault.
Oh, here we go again.
Yeah.
Barry hates Shea Given.
No, I don't.
League Two, at the top, Lincoln and NBA Dons both won against Morecambe and Carlisle, respectively. At the bottom, very worrying times. Sol Campbell's first win as Macclesfield manager, 2-0 over Crawley. There was a half-time floodlight failure. I mean, imagine that in this weather. You just didn't need that to have to be outside for any longer. Second bottom, Neil Ardley's Notts County also won, which means managerless Cambridge United's goalless draw at home to Yeovil doesn't mean a whole lot. George says, can you think of any better goal line scrambles than the one at Wingate and Finchley versus Dulwich Hamlet? Have we all seen this? Absolutely tremendous. There's the fullback on the post and the goalkeeper, and between them, they both make about four brilliant blocks, culminating in a sort of low diving-headed clearance where the guy's head is in the turf. That's how football should be played. Fit Bar Corner, Barry. David says, can you give the Scottish Prem credit for how competitive it is this season? 8 points separating the top eight almost halfway through the season. Great entertainment and big games every round of fixtures.
Yeah, it's... it looks like we have a title race in Scotland. The top five teams are... separated by just 4 points. Rangers gone back on top after the weekend. They had a very unconvincing 1-0 win against Hamilton. I think they had 22. They scored in the third minute, had 22 corners in the game, which sort of shows how dominant they were. But no Alfredo Morales, because he's suspended again after his 27th red card of the season. And it kind of shows how dependent they are on him. But they got away with it. Celtic were beaten 2-0.
Actually, I should say, Lafferty had a header that was saved. The save by the Hamilton keeper was absolutely unbelievable. It's like that, you know, when goalkeepers suddenly get an extra arm, you know, they dive and then their arm just stays in the air. It's quite amazing. Dig it out and find it.
Celtic lost 2-0 against Hibs, and there are problems at Celtic Park. I think quite a lot of their players are underperforming. I know Chris Sutton singled out Tom Rodgick and Scott Sinclair for a particular amount of criticism during their Europa League game on Thursday. Sinclair doesn't appear to be at the races at all. And the shock result of the weekend came on Friday night when Livingston beat Hearts 5-0. And in a game that was scoreless after 70 minutes, and Livingston scored 4 goals in 7 minutes and 5 in 14 to win it. And the referee also tried to send off the Hearts goalkeeper for a second yellow, even though he hadn't given him the first yellow. But he rescinded.
Is that a reverse poll?
So he booked him, thought it was his second booking, and it was brought to his attention that the goalie hadn't been booked before, so he was allowed to stay on. But a couple of minutes later, Hearts had someone else sent off. So, yeah, very entertaining game. And Craig Levein said afterwards that they made Livingston look like PSG. But I would say the way Hearts capitulated, Livingston made them look like PSG.
Right, that'll do for part two. We'll round up Europe in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Thanks very much. The top six all won, including a hat-trick and two assists for Lionel Messi. Still furious that he's only the fifth best player in the world, clearly.
It's very un-Spain, that, for the top six to win this season. It's been a weird season where lots of odd results have happened, where no one is entirely convinced. And this is going to sound very, very stupid, but Barcelona didn't always convinced yesterday, and yet they won 5-0. As you say, Messi scored three and provided two assists. It's probably worth pointing out at this stage that, of course, the nature of assists is that it depends on someone putting the ball away as well. So had the finishing been better, Messi could quite comfortably have scored three and provided five assists. He's now up to double figures in assists and goals. I think for the third year in a row, 12 of the last 13 seasons, he's got double figures in both assists and goals. And as I say, obviously, he's got there now. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's still only December.
That's ridiculous. Dieter says, what say you on the performances of Seville in La Liga? Will they challenge Barca for the title?
Well, they're close enough that it's possible to believe that they will. They play very quick. They're quite aggressive. They're very attacking. They're really enjoyable to watch. They play with two wing backs who aren't just an excuse to play with full backs, which obviously quite often is the case when teams do that. They've got a slight issue kind of overhanging things at the moment, which is there's a possibility of the club being sold. And obviously that means we don't know how that will impact upon what happens over the winter transfer window. The manager's already said that he needs new players. My suspicion is they won't compete for the title, but I think they are now without doubt the favourites to take the last, or maybe not even the last, maybe the second or the third of the Champions League places.
The Champions League draw obviously just happened. Barcelona have got Lyon, Real Madrid, Ajax and Atletico, Juventus. And none of them straightforward, are they?
No, I mean, look, I must admit, I think most people do this. I look at it from a kind of purely selfish point of view, and it's a slightly underwhelming draw from my point of view, which I suppose it was always likely to be. I say this, obviously, as someone who covers Spanish football. So of course, you know, the Liverpool game is really quite a big one. It's pretty exciting, I suppose, to see Atletico Madrid against Juventus. I think that will be really, really good. But obviously, I see it from a Spanish point of view. I suppose, in a way, it was always likely that it wouldn't be massively exciting what Madrid and Barcelona got, although, you know, ties that shouldn't be easy but not massively exciting because they both won their groups. And this year, unlike last year, it was largely top heavy in terms of which teams went through. So I think you look at the draw now and you say that Madrid and Barcelona should probably both get through. For Atletico Madrid, it's going to be much, much harder. I wonder how they'll approach that as well, because of course they're fundamentally quite defensive side, Atletico Madrid. There's no real reason to believe they'll change that, but I guess as always with these things, it'll be kind of conditioned by what happens in the first leg as to how they approach the second. And because they didn't win the group, they don't have that theoretical advantage of playing the second game at home.
Will Ronaldo get a nice welcome at Atletico?
Well, he'll get whistled and booed and abused. Does that count as a nice welcome?
Well, not really, I suppose.
I mean, that...
I know, fair point. What's this with Modric having a dig at Simeone?
Yeah, so Modric in an interview after winning the Ballon d'Or basically said that, you know, he's kind of had enough of what he described as Simeone's populist theories. This idea that whenever Simeone talks about Real Madrid, that he has to kind of make the point of putting them down, make the point that somewhere along the line there's some hidden interest, that Real Madrid are the favoured club of footballing authorities and power everywhere. Now, on one level at least, I think that's pretty unfair, because Simeone has quite repeatedly said in the build-up to this Ballon d'Or that there are two candidates as far as he's concerned, and one of those is a Real Madrid player, not Modric, but Varane, because of course what Simeone was doing was essentially taking this from the perspective of it has to be a Frenchman as a World Cup winners. So he wasn't backing Modric, he was suggesting that it shouldn't be Modric that wins the Ballon d'Or, but the player he was throwing in there was a Real Madrid one. That said, it certainly is true that, of course, Simeone draws quite often on this idea of Atletico Madrid being, you know, not as financially powerful, not as politically powerful as Real Madrid, and therefore there's even more merit in their triumphs. And Modric was annoyed about that. And then what happened at the weekend was that then Thibaut Courtois was asked about this, of course, the former Chelsea goalkeeper, but more importantly, former Atletico Madrid goalkeeper, now at Real Madrid. And he was asked, look, you know Simeone, you worked with Simeone for a long time, what do you think about this? And he said, well, this is entirely true. He said, you know, I won the best goalkeeper award at the World Cup. And Simeone said, I won it because now I'm at Real Madrid and wouldn't have won it when I was at Atletico. This goes back to Atletico's sense, particularly with La Liga awards, if not so much the Ballon d'Or, that they were overlooked. The year they won the league title, none of their players won the Player of the Year award. I mean, that was a bit of a joke, and that wasn't a real award in many ways, more a kind of a marketing thing. But he said, he says this about me, Simeone, and I won this award, but I still hadn't actually joined Real Madrid. I was still officially a Chelsea player at the time.
Sid, always nice to talk to you.
Pleasure.
Have a nice day, Sidlow.
Cheerio.
In Spain. Cheers, mate. From Spain, let's go to Italy, where Paolo Bandini has this roundup.
Francesco Totti reckons Roma got lucky being drawn against Porto in the last 16 of the Champions League. Personally, looking at how Roma are playing this season, I think it might be the other way around. They did win this weekend, but it wasn't pretty. They came from behind twice to beat Genoa at home and appeared to have gone behind for a third time in the second half, only for that goal to be wiped off by a VAR review, which was correct, but nevertheless a very marginal offside decision. Roma also should have had a penalty given against them in second half injury time, which could have brought the game back to 3-3 for a pretty blatant shove on Goran Pandev by Alessandro Florenzi. So all this against a Genoa team who, by the way, haven't won a game since September. Roma are generally an absolute disaster defensively at the moment. Eusebio Di Francesco, the manager, tried a back three here, but it doesn't make much difference when your goalkeeper is letting shots go clean through him, as Robin Olsen did on the opener. But Roma also don't have a viable striker when Edin Dzeko is injured, with Patrick Schick, the natural replacement, but currently clocking in at a rate of one goal every 4 months since joining for €40 million last summer. So they started with Nicolò Zaniolo up front here, who is 19 years old, joined as a make-weight in the deal that took Reggio Nainggolan to Inter, and most importantly, definitely isn't a striker. He's played pretty well in midfield, but hopelessly lost in this game. And you have to believe that Roma's owner, James Pallotta, will be talking strikers with sporting director Monchi when they meet this week in Boston. Though, again, the biggest problems are still at the other end of the pitch, where Roma have conceded 22 times now through 16 games, which is only six fewer than they did in 38 last season. Elsewhere, Juventus shockingly won the Turin derby, though they were very fortunate with the refereeing there as well. Alexandro looked to drag down Simone Zaza in the penalty area with the score still 0-0, but again, no VAR review. Bianconeri continued to look untouchable at the top of the Serie A table, but things do look tougher in Europe after they were drawn against Atletico Madrid in the last 16 of the Champions League, probably the toughest of the group runners-up. Manager Massimiliano Allegri was customarily quick to Twitter, though, writing that those with ambition have no fear.
Cheers, Paolo. In France, more postponements thanks to the Gilets Jaunes. No game for PSG, Bordeaux, Marseille, among others. Lille won to close the gap to top to just 10 points now. But PSG have two games in hand. Should just about be safe there. Another Monaco defeat, Mark, 3-0 away at Lyon.
Absolutely shocking performance from Monaco. Golovin was sent off as well. Thierry Henry had excuses in terms of injuries, and yes, they've still got some players out, but it was a pretty experienced team that was absolutely destroyed away to Lyon.
Yes, Thierry Henry said, without desire, it's hard to win. Pretty painful. 12 games in charge, 2 wins, 2 draws, 8 defeats, scored 8, conceded 23. From France to Germany, here's Archie Rintutt.
1 week to go until the Bundesliga winter break, and for the first time in 8 years, Borussia Dortmund will be top of the table at Christmas. They beat Werder Bremen 2-1 on Saturday night, all the goals coming in the first half. Cleverly worked free kick routine saw Bundesliga top scorer Paco Alcacer nod in his 11th of the season. Then, Jadon Sancho's tally of assists ticked up to 9 when he laid up Marco Reus to make it 2-0. Max Kruse slammed in a long-range half-volley, which was pretty impressive, to pull one back for Bremen, but Dortmund good value for the win in the end. Seeing Dortmund against Spurs will be a cracking tie in the Champions League. Two very evenly matched sides compared to the games last season. How Spurs handle Axel Witsel at the heart of the Dortmund midfield will be key. Dortmund's lead at the top, excuse my illness, is 9 points over 2 teams on 30 points. Borussia Mönchengladbach firstly in second, who escaped Hoffenheim with a goalless draw. Given the run of play, Gladbach had goalkeeper Jan Sommer to thank. Then, in third, it's Bayern, who walloped Hannover 4-0. Pick of the goals was David Alaba's half-volley thunderbolt from the edge of the area. On the face of it, they're hitting their best form of the season, but I would say let's wait and see how they perform in the coming week against fourth-place Leipzig, who were 4-1 winners over Mainz, and Eintracht Frankfurt, who won 2-1 against Leverkusen. Both of those results on Sunday. Too much bigger tests than the ones that Bayern got against Hannover and Nuremberg, who offered just the one shot on target between them. Liverpool, I think, will cause Bayern a lot of problems as it stands, but good while yet before those games come around. As for City against Schalke, I worry for Schalke. 3 points off the relegation playoff spot, playing poorly. I don't think that will end well for them on Leroy Sané's homecoming. But I can harp on about all of this when, to be honest, everything in Germany this weekend was put into context with what happened in Stuttgart. Shortly after their 2-1 win at home to Hertha on Saturday, the father of club captain Christian Gentner, who had been in the stadium watching his son as ever, passed away in the Mercedes-Benz Arena, having just watched his son play. Something that Gentner found out shortly after full time, the sort of thing that puts the football into perspective. Sometimes it really just does not matter.
Cheers, Archie. Obviously, all of our thoughts with Christian Gentner and his family. Funny tweet here from Hayes and Yedding United, saying they're thanking a player for his contribution this season as he departs for regular first-team football at South Park FC. Would you like to know the player's name, Barry?
Go on.
Great Evans.
Okay.
What a wonderful name that is.
Yeah.
Great. Any other business now? We've had the... we know how many people from each country listen to the pod. So there are some countries where only one person... We have one person listening. Would you like to know those countries? We could do a show for just one person sitting on a chair in Dominica, Congo, French Guiana, Liechtenstein, Turks and Caicos Islands, Greenland, Tajikistan and Chad.
Be anyone in Antarctica, I think. They do a thing like this on Kermode and Mayo's Five Live Film
do
Review.
They?
They're able to track where people are.
We've got two in the following countries. They could meet. If you're two of the people in Togo... Or
we're now actually turning into a cover version of Kermode and Mayo's.
But that doesn't matter. For people who listen to it, it might be a problem. For me, I don't listen to it, so it's fine. So do they do this as well?
Yeah,
could the two people in Burkina Faso who listen to the pod meet? That also goes for Guadeloupe, Somalia, Lesotho, the Cook Islands, and St. Kitts and Nevis. Would you like me to do the whole list or finish there?
Which country is biggest? The UK, I suppose?
And UK and then America. And then Australia, I think. They're the top three. But we're big in New York. We could fill Madison Square Garden. Could we fill Madison Square Garden? No, we couldn't fill Madison Square Garden. Could we fill in New York? Central Park? No, we couldn't fill there. We could fill, you know, a sort of mid-range League Two stadium. If Six Fields was moved to New York, then we could fill that. If everybody came. It's a big ask.
Well, a certain former producer of ours used to constantly dangle an American tour in front of us without ever delivering. So, you know, maybe producer Jonathan can get on the case.
Oh, excellent. Breaking news from producer Jonathan. We've picked up a listener in Greenland, so we now have two.
Fantastic.
Which is marvellous, isn't it?
That's wonderful technology. Have you like a map in front of you? Or?
Oh, I see. We've gone from 0 to 1, not 1 to 2 in Greenland. No, I don't have. I've just got a list. But
maybe
yeah.
Santa Claus is downloading it before his big trip next week.
Any other business? Lowbird says, I listen to the pod as I cycle around London tutoring Latin. Which is a niche job, isn't it? Shouting Latin on a bicycle.
I don't think he should be cycling and listening at the same time. It's dangerous.
It is dangerous. Do take care. He says, as a Yorkshireman, I can assert that Yorkshire pudding can be cooked with any meat, which produces dripping. Thank you for that. Marco says, you should try Christmas cake with cheddar or Wensleydale. Really good. I enjoy the pot on my way home in New Jersey. Happy Christmas, everyone. And David has a question, which we will finish on. Which fruit could you throw the furthest? I mean, I think an apple.
Yeah, I reckon. An
apple's a solid
it's
chair.
It's quite ball-like, isn't it? It's got a bit of weight to it.
Yeah, it's a good shout.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a fascinating answer, isn't it? Jonathan says an orange would roll further. I don't think so. You do need to think about this. And this is what the people want.
I think we could maybe ask that Spurs fan that through the banana.
You see, I think you could probably throw a banana further, but it's obviously not a very nice thing to do. It's frowned upon.
Yeah,
if you would have to make it clear, you know, this is a scientific experiment.
Okay.
I'm not a racist.
Yeah,
but I do think because the length thing, you could sort of boomerang it, but then it might come back to you.
Possible, isn't it?
Would you throw it straight, or would you kind of try and discus?
I would.
You would never discus it, would you?
I would hold the curved end facing away from me, and then grab the stalk and just sort of ninja star through the air.
I'm absolutely convinced, and I don't have a great arm, that I could throw a firm Granny Smith a long way further than you could throw a banana. Please end now. Yeah. Marcus, thanks for coming.
Cheers. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Baz.
You're welcome.
Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.